Old Testament, there's a lot of important principles that we can benefit from that is taught there. I want you to notice as we look at the book of Malachi just for a few minutes this morning that some of the sacrifices of the people that were being offered in the temples and the kind of attitude that they were displaying. I had the scripture read so that you could see not only the people's attitude, what they were offering, but what God's attitude was about that. Can you imagine? I mean, when you look at some of these things they brought, they had no reverence for God whatsoever. And I can't even imagine that they would bring something to services and put in, offer Him that they had stolen. That would be like me robbing a bank last week and then putting that in the collection plate this morning and expecting God to somehow accept that. But that's what they were doing. And the sacrifices, he sort of characterizes them as ones that were flawed and blemished. They were the ones that were the old broken down sheep, the ones that weren't very good anymore, couldn't produce, weren't going to do them any good. So they brought those things that were of no use. And as you look at God's response, His attitude was, if this is the kind of worship that you're going to offer me, you might as well just shut the doors. Just shut the doors to the temple. And I want you to notice verses 6 through 9. He sort of makes some connects it to some human relationships and uses some human illustrations. He says in verse 6, a son will honor his father, and a servant will honor his master. He says, I'm a father, but where's my honor? And I'm a master, but where's my respect? I don't even receive the kind of respect that you give people in human relationships. And he makes a point of comparing their service with him to him also in verse 8 with that of service to a governor. Did you notice that? Look at verse 8 again. Service to a governor. And the point is, he says, when you present the blind for service, is it not evil? And when you present the lame and sick, is it not evil? Why then not offer it to your governor? Would he be pleased with you? He says, try it with the governor. Would he even accept it? Take these sacrifices to him. You've got to pay your taxes. Maybe take him some of these animals that you've been bringing to me and see if he would accept it. See if he would say to you, well done, that's just what I was looking for. Of course he wouldn't take those sacrifices. And he says, if on the lesser level, if he wouldn't accept them, why do you think that I would accept them as well? And he feels very offended. I am a great king, he said at the very end of that chapter. Well, I kind of like to take this principle that we see here, and I'd like to this idea of try it with your governor, and I would like to make an application this morning. Sometimes we read these Old Testament prophets and we don't know what to do with them. Sometimes they seem like there's no way to find any practical application for them in our lives. But yeah, I thought about that this time of year. We're thinking a little bit more about the government, not about the election, but at least some of us, at least around this time, we've started gathering our documents together because of one particular branch of the government's in view, the IRS. So we've been getting our documents together and putting them together and getting them in order and getting our forms filled out. We're preparing to pay our taxes in about a month. So I want to frame our lesson this way this morning, just for a point of reference. And imagine trying some of these things with the IRS. And in a few minutes, we'll make that application and say, let's try it with the Lord. All right? So try this with your governor. Try this with the IRS. Try this one. This is the way we've always done it. You know, this is the way that my fathers did it. This is the way I file my taxes with the IRS. It's the way we've always done it. It's a tradition. How far do you think that would go? Is it going to fly? How far would you get with an IRS agent who sat down? Let's imagine even that you got audited. Imagine that all of us got audited this year and an IRS agent came to your house, or maybe you had to go and have a meeting, and he sat down with you and he said, we've got some problems here. We've got some things we need to talk about. The way that you did your taxes. And he says, this is wrong. And you say, well, but this is the way I've always done it. It's the way I did it. My father did it. This is just the way we do things. And how far would you get with that line of reasoning to justify your actions and how you filled out your return? Or maybe how about this one? This is the way everybody else is doing it. Everybody else fills them out this way, so this is the way I fill them out. You know, these things are really real. They really happen. I have a fellow that helps me out with my taxes. His name is Alan Jones. He's a good fellow in Indiana. He's a preacher of the gospel, but he also is a certified IRS agent. So he does taxes for people, and particularly for me and other preachers. And he said every once in a while somebody will ask him a question about something. And he'll get his tax code manual out, and he'll start to read it to them. They'll say, well, wait a minute. They'll say, his response is, I've made several calls to some people. And I've talked to several people, and they say that people are doing it this way. And so they don't want to listen to the rest of his response when he wants to read them the tax code. And they won't listen to what he says. And they say, you know, I've made some phone calls, and everybody else is doing it this way. Well, my question is, try that on the IRS. Sit down with an agent when he comes in and say to them, well, that's the way everybody else is doing it, and see how far that gets you. Try that with the governor. Or maybe try this. This is the way the old law read. You know, back in 1995, you know, that's the way it read, and so wouldn't it be good enough now? Of course, the tax laws seem to be changing all the time. I mean, you know, right up to the last minute, Congress can make a change in a tax law that affects the entire year. It can be December, the end of the tax year, and they can make a decision that will change the way your taxes are looked at the entirety of that year, all the way back to January. But you know, try it with the IRS. Well, that's the way the old law read. That's the way the tax code was written in the past. And so that's my justification for the way that I fill it out this time. Try that with the governor. See how it works. This is what I feel is right. Try that. In preparing your taxes. You know, you run across some things sometime in the tax system and the way they do things. And you know, it really doesn't seem like it ought to be that way. It's just not fair. And you might be right. But try that with an IRS agent. Do it your way. And when he sits down and says, we have some problems here with the way you fill this out, you say, well, I don't feel it should be that way. I think it ought to be this way. And you know, how far would you get with that? Would he say, you know, I can sympathize with that. I understand exactly what you're talking about. I kind of agree with you too. And so I guess if you feel that way about it, then that's the way we should evaluate your taxes. Try that with your governor. See if he would agree with you on that line of reasoning. Or maybe this last one. This is what the experts told me. We often turn it over to someone who studies the tax law to do our preparation. I do that. I tell you, I don't want to make a mistake. This can be trouble if you make mistakes on your taxes. And I'm not versed in the law on that. And so we might give that to someone who's studied the law and seems responsible and knows how those laws change, and it gives us a sigh of relief. Feel more confident about it. But do you know something? When you sign your name at the end of that, the bottom of those forms, then you assume full responsibility for your taxes and the way that you prepared them. Whether you prepared it or whether somebody else prepared it, that's one of the experts. And so you sit down, this agent sits down with you, and he puts your documents out there and he says, this is not right. This didn't come out like we figured it. And you say to him, but that's what, you know, this expert told me. That's what he did it, and he said it, that's the way it is. Do you think the IRS would be sympathetic to that? You know, the experts told me to do it this way. Well, you know, he would say, but if it's wrong, it's still wrong. And if you owe money, and there's a penalty, and there's some interest to be paid on top of it, then you still owe that money. And there's still a penalty, and there's still interest to be paid. And it won't get you off the hook to say, well, that's what the experts told me. That's why I did it that way. You know, God said to Israel in Malachi, try these things with your governor. Try these things with a human authority. And our illustration here is, try these things with the IRS. And are these things going to fly? Are these reasons going to be adequate for them? I think we can see the fallacy of that on a human level, just as we can see the problem with taking the lame or the sick or blind animals to a governor in Malachi. If it won't work on the lower level, why would we think it would work on a higher level? But just one more thing, just to emphasize this point, on this lower level example, you know, how should we approach our responsibility to the IRS? The only question, the only question that really matters is, what does the current law say? That's what matters. They have a publication. This is what we need to remember that. They have a publication called Publication 17. And it's a document that maybe you've used before. It's kind of a point of reference for a person that wants to fill out his forms. And it'll go start you right at the beginning to help you out. It'll tell you how to put your name and address in there. And at the end, it'll tell you how to sign it. And in the middle, it'll give you the way to fill out your forms. And it tells you everything. But there's a disclaimer that they put on that publication. It says, the explanations and examples in this publication reflect the interpretation by the Internal Revenue Service of the tax laws enacted by Congress, Treasury regulations, and court decisions. However, the information given does not cover every situation and is not intended to replace the law or change its meaning. And that's pretty clear. If there's some kind of issue in a dispute, you end up going to how the IRS interprets the law. There's how I interpret the law, and then there's the law. And when you go to court, the judges, they look at it and they see which interpretation more accurately reflects the law. But the bottom line is, is the law. What is it? And the IRS will say, you can use this to prepare your publications, but we're saying right up front, it's not the law. It's not the law. And so everything goes back to the law. What does the current law enacted by Congress say? That's the only relevant question when you're filling out your taxes. Well, so if these arguments that we looked at a while ago, this idea of, this is how I've always done it, this is the way everybody else does it, that's the way the old law read, this is what I feel is right, this is what the experts told me, if those things won't work with the governor, then will they work with God? I want us to take those arguments that we use to the IRS and put them in a spiritual context. Let's see if they work with God. Let's look at the first one. The first one, what I've always done. This is the way I've always done it. It's the way my father did it. It's the way my grandfather did it. This is the religious tradition I've always practiced. It's a religion my family has always had. And that's why I do it this way. Does that justify us religiously before God? Would the governor accept it when we use that? Will God accept it? Let's look back in your Old Testament real quick again. If you're in 2 Kings, turn over to chapter 17. This is after the kingdom was divided and God took the kingdom away from Solomon, he gave it to he divided it and he gave it to two other men, Jeroboam and Rehoboam. And chapter 17 in verse 21 talks about Jeroboam's kingdom and the way he did things. And you remember that he, while God divided the kingdom, he kept the location of where worship was to be done in the same place in Jerusalem. But Jeroboam set up some golden calves in Dan and Bethel, the north and south ends of the northern kingdom. And they practiced that. And it says, when he had torn Israel from the house of David, they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. Then Jeroboam drove Israel away from following the Lord and made them commit a great sin. And the sons of Israel walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel from his sight as he spoke through all his servants the prophets. So Israel was carried away into exile from their own land to Assyria until this day. There was a long-standing tradition practiced by Jeroboam There was a religious tradition that really was practiced for a couple of hundred years. And the question is, in this, does the length of time someone has practiced something make it right? What if you were born 200 years after Jeroboam? What if you were born 200 years after Jeroboam and you grow up in the northern kingdom? And you'd worship these golden calves in Dan and Bethel, and you'd done it all your life. That's the way your parents did it. That's the way your grandparents did it. That's how they brought you up. How did the Lord like that idea? This is how we've always done it. Didn't fly, did it? Didn't matter how many years that other people had done it. It doesn't make it right. And eventually God took all of them away into captivity because they practiced sin. You know, when you do it wrong the first year, you know, the next year it's still wrong. It's still sin. And then two generations removed from that, it's still sin as well. You can't make something right because it's always been done that way. And yet that scene is funny. If we see in our own culture, just in moral things, a couple hundred years ago, there were things that were practiced or things that would never be practiced. If they were, maybe people have been put to death. I mean, they were just unheard of. But look where we are today. And how many of those things have just... It doesn't happen overnight. But over a couple of centuries, things that were just clearly black and white 200 years ago are not even gray. I mean, they are acceptable. Now, we will argue for those things. You know, this is nothing new. But that argument, what I've always done, when God is saying, would your governor accept that kind of reasoning? Well, on a lower level, well, why do you think I would accept that reasoning? Those things happen. I'm not going to look at all these other ones, but it happened in the New Testament. The Apostle Paul, when he was Saul of Tarsus, was very steeped in the traditions of his elders. And he practiced them with zeal. I mean, he was fervent about those things. He believed in those things. It's what he had always done. But in the process of following what had always been done, he rejected Christ because Christ introduced something that had not been done, that was not consistent with the way it had always been done. And so he put to death the Christians that followed Jesus, just like Jesus himself had been put to death for changing the way things were always done. And God had to confront him and convince him that he was in the wrong, and he had to make a change about that. What I've always done didn't work for the governor, and it won't work with God. What about what everybody else is doing? Didn't work with the IRS, did it? Would it work with God? Do we stand before God at the judgment day and say, well, this is what everybody else was doing? Does the number of people doing it make a difference? Genesis chapter 6, verse 5 through 9 talks about the days of Noah. And if there was anybody who could make an argument that everybody else is doing it, surely Noah could have made that. He was quite literally, I guess in addition to it, he had several members of his family with him. But beyond those eight people, everybody there was doing something, and it was wrong. It says, the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of the heart was on evil continually. And the Lord was very sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. The Lord said, I'll blot out man whom I've created from the face of the land, and from man to animals to creeping things to birds of the sky, for I'm sorry that I made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Noah was righteous because he didn't do what everybody else was doing. He walked in the commandments of God. The majority were doing something different. But just because the majority does it, it doesn't make it right. It's wrong if one person does it. It's wrong if everybody does it. And the same is true if you look over your New Testament in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 5, with the Israelites in the wilderness. Paul brought this incident up as he discussed some problems in the church at Corinth. 603,550 people God brought out of Egypt, carried them across the Red Sea, took them to a new land, gave them a place to live, fulfilling his promises to Abraham. Told them to go in and take it. Take the land, it's all yours. But they listened to 10 of the spies out of the 12. It says here, nevertheless, most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. All of those people came to the promised land. They had everything going for them, conquest of the land before them, but they listened to the majority, didn't they? 10 out of 12. 10 voices are more powerful than 2. And so they all rejected God's instruction to them to go in. They didn't listen to what the spies said, the other 2. And of course, they were all left in the wilderness. All the fighting force, only a few, went into the wilderness or into the land of promise. It didn't work with the governor. Will it work with God, this idea of what everybody else is doing? You know, if the majority of churches of Christ, let me make this practical, if the majority of churches of Christ, all right, say that we can use instrumental music, that's all right if we do that. Does that make it right? Would we do it? I mean, wonder if every congregation that you could even think of changed their position within the next, whatever, so many years, would that make it right? Well, we would all probably shake our head. But it might make it harder to stay true to what we believe the Bible says, wouldn't it? What if all the churches of Christ said that the Lord's Supper should just be with one cup? Everybody, across the board, they decided we got it wrong. It should be with one cup. Would that make it right? Would we felt the pressure of everybody else doing it a certain way, that we would need to do it too because that's the right way to do it? If we try this argument with the governor, you know, everybody else is doing it. Tax IRS agent says, I don't like the way you did your taxes. It's not right. You say, well, everybody else is doing it. Would it work? You know, the key is not the number of people doing something, but what the law says. That's the only question. Because a lot of people can be wrong. If it won't work with the governor, will it work with God? What about what the old law says? Did it work with the IRS? Will it work with God? This is what the law said. This is what the old law said. It's good enough for me. Individuals will stand up on judgment day and say, I live this way because the law of God said that's what I should do. The old law. Will that work with God to justify practices from the Old Testament? Well, look at one verse here in Romans chapter 4, or Romans chapter 7. It's a human illustration of relationship between Christians and law. And he says, do you not know, brethren, for I am speaking to those who know the law, that the law is jurisdiction over a person as long as he lives? For the married woman is bound by law to her husband while he's living, but if her husband dies, she's released from the law concerning her husband. So then, if while her husband is living, she's joined to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she's free from the law, so that she is not an adulteress, though she is joined to another man. He's trying to tell these people, you can't follow two laws at one time, any more than a woman can be married to two husbands at once. Yes, if a woman's husband dies, he says, she can be free from that man and she can marry again without committing adultery. But only if the death of her husband takes place first. So he says in verse 4, therefore, my brethren, you also were made to die to the law through the body of Christ, that you might be joined to another, to him who was raised from the dead, that we might bear fruit to God. He says, you die to the law. So you're released from the law like the woman was released from her husband. So you can be married to Christ without committing spiritual adultery. Otherwise, if you try to practice both, you're committing spiritual adultery, would be the idea. By being under old law while trying to follow Christ and being married to Him at the same time. That makes logical sense, doesn't it? Even with the illustration of going to the IRS. You can't go by the old law if it's been replaced by a new law. And Paul makes those arguments too in other books when he says he's under law to Christ. Or he makes some arguments in Colossians chapter 2 that the old law was nailed to the cross, put to the death. and that they shouldn't be judged by those old laws and regulations. A lot of material in the New Testament trying to convince the Jews who had lived under that old law for so long, that's gone. It's done away. It's obsolete. And you can't live under two laws. So, you know, the old law would not justify us before the governor. Would it justify us before God? Would that argument work? You know, well, God, I've been practicing what your law said all my life. He would say, yeah, but that law changed. Would it work if you use that argument with an IRS agent? We would all say no. It would be just as crystal clear. Nobody would. Well, if it wouldn't work with him on a lower level, what about with God on a higher level? Well, what about this one? What I feel is right. So many people feel that they can't understand the Bible for themselves and that they have to leave it up to an expert. Sometimes it's a priest. Sometimes it's a theologian. You know, sometimes it's to the church, some kind of church body or administration that needs to interpret it for them. I'm afraid that we worship the experts in our country. It's probably it's one of the many golden calves that we have. People rely on experts. They rely on them, but they won't study the Bible for themselves many times. You know, many people in Jesus' day relied on the experts too. What did the Pharisees say about it? Look in Matthew chapter 15 and verse 14. The Pharisees were the religious leaders of Jesus' day. Wait a minute, I just started on the next point. That was good. That was pretty smooth. Let's go to the next point, and we'll come back to the point before that. How about that? Sorry about that. My bad. Matthew chapter 15, verse 14. The Pharisees had a lot to say, had a lot of sway over the people. People depended on them, relied on them, listened to them. If you can't trust the religious leaders, who can you trust? So they listened to them and followed them implicitly. And Jesus said to his disciples, as they were perhaps observed some of these people following the Pharisees down the road in their traditions and not listening to Jesus, he said, listen, let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind. And if a blind man guides a blind man, both will fall into the pit. Both will fall into the pit. You know, it's amazing. While we can't decide, you know, while we can decide on the one hand to give our taxes to an expert and let them do those for us, we can't leave our souls in the hands of experts. We shouldn't do that. I mean, it's dangerous, in a sense, to let other people do your taxes. How much more dangerous is it to entrust our souls to other people? Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 4, let's look at that. Ephesians. Let's start in verse 3. By revelation there was made known to me the mystery as I wrote beforehand in brief. And by referring to this, when you read, you can understand my insight into the mystery of Christ. So Paul presumed that when people read his letter, that it was possible that for them to understand what it was. And then he came back to that point again in chapter 5 and verse 16. He says, make the most of your time because the days are evil, so then don't be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. There were a lot of people in the first century misleading saints with other messages, but these saints were responsible to understand what the will of the Lord is. And he calls them, John, in 1 John chapter 1, 4 and verse 1, he calls them to distinguish between those that were true spirits and those who were false spirits. There were lots of spirits out there. There was the Spirit of God, there was the Spirit of error, and there were true prophets that spoke from the Spirit of God and false prophets that spoke from the Spirit of error. And he said, you've got to test those spirits. That's your job. You have a responsibility to do that. And so he really puts the responsibility on the individual, not on the preachers or on the leaders. He puts it on the responsibility of each individual to look at the truth and find out what it said. You know, the experts, I think, are sometimes the most dangerous people of all, because they curry so much confidence and so much, and people are so willing to entrust themselves to them. No. But you know, when an IRS agent sits down at your table and he says, we have a problem, and we look and we say, listen, the expert said, he's going to say, I'm sorry, that's not sufficient. You signed that paper. You are responsible for what's on this paper. And that's the same way it's going to be with God. It's not the experts. It's going to be judged for us in our place. But we have to answer for ourselves. And then lastly, what if I feel is right? What about that? Will that work? Did it work with the governor? It's so many people. People can be so logical in so many realms of life except religion. And it's all about feelings. People that I know that can be very, very intellectual, very logical, very objective, and do very complicated, complex things in their job, and they are very able to, deal with things objectively, and then they'll come to religion and they'll just throw all that objectivity right out the window. And feelings will govern everything they do as they look at their relationship to God. But we would quickly admit that that won't work with an IRS agent. He's not going to. You can't say, this is how I feel about it should be. And he wouldn't say, yeah, that's what I understand. I can agree with you on that. But will it work with God? Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 12. Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 12. He said, there's a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. There's a way that seems right to do your taxes, but it'll cost you lots of money and penalties and interest. It seems right, but it's not according to the law. Many people on the day of judgment will be disappointed because they followed their feelings. They did what seemed right, but it wasn't according to God's law. Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 23. Jeremiah was telling the people, I know, O Lord, that a man's way is not in himself, nor is it in a man who walks to direct his steps. It's not in my best interest to follow my own way. I'm an unreliable person when it comes to the way I feel about things. I may feel very strongly, but that's not the basis on which I should be guided, rather by God's divine guidance. Paul always did what he thought was right, but it wasn't always right. Acts chapter 26, as Paul recounted his experience prior to becoming a Christian, in verse 9 it says, So then I thought to myself that I had to do many things hostile to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And this is just what I did in Jerusalem. Not only did I lock up many of the saints in prisons, having received authority from the chief priests, but also when they were being put to death, I cast my vote against them. I punished them often in synagogues. I tried to force them to blaspheme. Being furiously enraged with them, I kept pursuing them, even to foreign cities. And we know the rest of the story. Was God okay, since Paul really felt that that's what he needed to do? He was zealous. I mean, it was deep in his heart. He believed what he was doing was right. But he was totally wrong. He was wrong. We can be just as far off in our religious zeal as Paul is. Just because we feel it, that doesn't make it right. Try it on the governor. Try it on the IRS. This is the way I feel it should be. Is it going to work with an IRS agent? Will he accept it? That's what I was looking for. That's exactly what I was looking for. I said, no, it won't work with him. It won't work with God. Well, I hope this little example of the will be helpful to you. I want you to just remember this question. It's only one that matters. What does the current law say? What does the law of Christ say? John chapter 12, verse 48, when Jesus was teaching in his time here on earth. He says, he who rejects me and does not receive my sayings has one who will judge him. The word I spoke is what will judge him on the last day. It won't be what I've always done. It won't be what everybody else is doing. It won't be what the old law says. It won't be how I feel. It won't be what the experts say. The question is, what did Christ say? It wouldn't work with the governor. God says he uses that illustration for their benefit. He uses it for ours. Bring these sacrifices to the governor. Would he accept them? Would he say, that's exactly what I was looking for? I'd say, no. Well, why would we think if it wouldn't work for him, it would work for God? So let's be looking to the law of Christ so we can be found acceptable. A builder that does what God has asked, uses the blueprint that he asked, not putting forth things before God in the day of judgment that would not even work with a governor here on earth. If it won't work with him, how much less would it work with God? So this morning, what we do when we invite somebody to become a Christian, we say, what is God's terms? What is it that he said? I don't know how you feel. I don't know what all the experts say, but what did God say? We need to get our Bibles and read. What did Christ say? He who believes and is baptized will be saved. That's what he said. If you confess me before men, I will confess you before my Father who is in heaven. We've got to be willing to do that. Not just today in front of an assembly. That's kind of a... would be important for people to know that you are naming Jesus as your Lord, but that's the only best that we can do. If that, it's not a whole lot of a threat, is it? To confess Him right here before everybody else who believes it. But if we're not willing to confess Him in our daily life before others, then would He confess us before His Father in the end? We've got to read, what did Jesus say? That's the basis on which we can have confidence. If we follow Him, then He will keep His promises. This morning, if you would do that, become a Christian, and then we would invite you to do it while together we stand and sing our song.